Today, cutting and cutting again. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly to the 6th of July 2019. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In our latest digest to the 6th of July 2019, we look at why central banks are calling the shots, the further expectations for interest rates, and the risks to iron ore prices ahead, as well as the latest local property news. And this week we start with the Australian scene, where the RBA cut the cash rate once again, APRA confirmed their mortgage lending loosening, and the terms of international trade hit a high. And let's start with trade. In May, Australia's trade surplus climbed to a fresh record high, rising to $5.75 billion, up from $4.8 billion in April. This was above consensus expectations. Within this, exports rose by 3.6% or $1.4 billion, double the forecasts. In addition, imports were up by 1.5% or $0.5 billion, again higher than expected. As a result, the trade surplus widened to a new record high in 2019. The main driver of this astonishing result can be traced to export earnings from higher commodity prices, notably iron ore, following the tailings dam disaster in Brazil at the same time as we have stronger demand for ore imports from China. The spot iron ore rate nearly hit $130 this week before falling back on Friday. More of that later. Thanks to the larger trade surpluses, the current account deficit narrowed sharply to be at historic lows, coming in at only 0.6% of GDP in the March quarter, the smallest deficit since 1979 and before that 1975. These higher commodity prices are boosting mining profits and in turn tax revenues, therefore providing federal government with additional flexibility in fiscal policy. In fact, there is the possibility that the federal underlying cash balance edged into surplus in the year 2018-19, 1 year ahead of schedule. And that would be the first surplus since 2007-8, ahead of the impact of the GFC. But it all hinges on the iron ore price. According to Bloomberg, the Department of Industry, Innovation and Science reported that iron ore exports from Australia are set to post the first annual drop in almost two decades following bad weather and output setbacks, worsening a global shortage and bolstering prices that have already surged to a five-year high. That would be the first contraction since 2001. Last year, Australia exports totaled 835 million tonnes, and this will push the value of Australia's exports to around $55 billion in fiscal 2020, reflecting the higher prices that are largely due to the Vale Dam disaster in January. The department said that the iron ore price is expected to be higher than previously forecast and for longer due to the limited capacity of other operations in Australia and elsewhere to ramp up and replace Vale's production loss of high-grade supply, at least in the short term. Rio Tinto Group and BHP Group both revised down their annual production outlooks in the wake of Cyclone Veronica in the first half, and Rio in June further lowered its output target after problems at its sprawling operations in Western Australia. And the price dropped on Friday after a top official of the China Iron and Steel Association said authorities would crack down on illegal behaviour relating to iron ore price manipulation. Qiu Shi, deputy head of the CISA, said iron ore prices have formed a severe inverse relationship with steel output prices in China, and the Chinese authorities, noticing the sharp rise in iron ore prices, are investigating the cause and will strictly crack down on behaviours disturbing the market, including unjustified price increases and price manipulation. The slide in steel output prices and soaring iron ore prices have continuously cut down the profitability of steel companies, making it difficult for steel companies in China to cope, and is damaging the sustainability of their steel industry. Analysts say that the price of iron ore has increased more than the extent that can be supported by fundamentals like supply and demand. And the ABC reported that iron ore prices may be booming for now, but they might be about to fall, as the high prices encourage other miners like Indonesia, Malaysia, and even China itself to come back into the market. Plus, the trade wars between the USA and China are also having an impact, and freight charges are lower. That changes the economics of exporting iron ore. So the bottom line is our economy is overly reliant on iron ore, and if prices do fall, those trade surpluses could weaken with a hit to our overall GDP. This week, the ABS released their retail figures for May. The trend estimate rose 0.2%. This follows a rise of 0.2% in April and a rise of 0.2% in March. The seasonally adjusted estimate rose 0.1% in May. This follows a fall of 0.1% in April and a rise of 0.3% in March. In trend terms, Australian turnover rose 2.7% in May 2019 compared with a year earlier. And household goods retailing fell again, down 0.1% in trend terms. And home approvals remained weak in May, with the trend estimate for total dwelling approved down 0.5%. In fact, in trend terms, private sector house approvals fell by 1.3%, while private sector dwellings, excluding houses, rose 0.6% across the states. Total approvals rose a little in Queensland and South Australia, together with a big hike in Canberra, but on small volumes, while there was a percentage fall in New South Wales and Victoria, Western Australia and the Northern Territories. And we discussed all this in our post, The Latest on Building Approvals. Of course, we've seen a whole raft of steps to kickstart the property market again, including a second rate cut from the RBA to a new low of 1%, APRA released the taps on mortgage standards by dropping the 7% buffer and letting individual banks set their own risk parameters. See our post, APRA opens the lending taps. Other steps include the tax cuts, which were approved this week, and I discussed this on TENS The Project.
Tax cuts, can we afford them, and are they fair?
Well, on that note, Martin North is a finance guru, which is exactly what we need right now. So, Martin, the argument is all about stage three, and particularly the flattening of that tax for those at the high end of the income earning spectrum. What do you think? Can we afford it?
Well, it's a long way down the track, and I think we've got some more immediate issues. Frankly, the economy is a lot weaker than many thought it was before the election. And, you know, I think we should be looking near term rather than 5 years down the track. The way the tax system works has to work for the benefit of the broader community and the broader population. As you release the tax at the top end, essentially that means that quite a lot of money stops flowing into the economy, right? And therefore that creates a lot of issues. And it really does begin to take us to a direction other than the US, where we have the haves and we have the have-nots. We have those at the top end of town who are doing quite well, but the broader base in the economy, those who are really struggling now, are not going to see much of it. So to my mind, this is taking us down an economic backwater if we're not very careful.
What about those first two stages? Are they going to help people who are struggling right now?
Well, at the margin, they may a little. And we certainly know from our surveys that a lot of people are really struggling with high costs of living, flat incomes. So every little helps. But the surveys also say that what they're going to do is essentially not spend it. They're going to effectively pay off the mortgage faster, or they're going to save it because they're worried about the broader conditions in the economy. So I'm not sure that it will flow through really to much improved economic activity. And frankly, I think it's just playing around the edge. We haven't really understood how serious the issues are.
Well, fairness and effectiveness aside, Martin, when can we expect to see this first round of tax cuts in our pocket?
Well, of course, they should flow through. Once the tax returns go in, you should then get a credit back. I guess it depends on when you put the tax return in and how long the ATO takes to process it all. But, you know, probably 2 or 3 months, if you're lucky, you'll see that. But the question is, will it get blotted up with everything else that's going on, and will people really see the difference? That's the big question for me.
All right, Martin, thank you very much for your expertise.
Good to talk to you.
OK, time for...
Then the additional plan to assist first-time buyers will come in from January. And so economist John Adams and I discussed all of this. In the interests of the people, federal politicians are in negative equity and stressed. This is all about the kitchen sink that's being thrown. This was released earlier today. Of course, many commentators are talking up the market, claiming that the high debts are not an issue and people should buy. But we think caution is needed, as much of the good work which was achieved from the Royal Commission is now being unpicked. But there are some signs of increased momentum in the property market nevertheless. For example, the price movements from CoreLogic. So looking at the CoreLogic index to the 4th of July 2019, in Sydney over the last week, property prices rose 0.1%. Over the quarter, they've dropped down 1.01%. Annually, they've fallen 9.9%, and from their peak, they're now down 15%. In Melbourne, they rose 0.1% last week. They've fallen 0.55% over the quarter. They fell 9.2% over the last year, and they're down 11% from their peak. In Brisbane, last week, they fell 0.09%. Over the quarter, prices are down 1.34%. Annually, they're down 2.6%. And from their peak, they're also down 2.6%. In Adelaide, over the last week, prices rose 0.03%. Over the quarter, they fell 0.41%. Over the last year, they're down 0.3%. And from peak, they're down 1%. In Perth, prices fell again, down 0.03%. Over the quarter, they fell 2.18%. Annually, they've fallen 9.1%. And they're 19.9% from peak. And in the five major centres, prices overall rose 0.02% over the last week. They're down 1.03% over the quarter. They've fallen 8.3% over the last year, and they're down 10.8% from their last peak. And once again, to emphasise, these are averages. Individual postcodes vary considerably. And we can also track the changes over the last year. Sydney is still more than 10% down. Melbourne, just slightly less than 10%. Brisbane continues to slide. Adelaide is slightly down. And Perth continues to fall. And the five-city average continues to track lower. And the latest auction results from CoreLogic shows that last week 1,295 homes were taken to auction across the combined capital cities, returning a final auction clearance rate of 62.9%. That is the highest clearance rate recorded since April last year, and the third consecutive week where the clearance rate was held above 60%. Melbourne saw 535 homes taken to auction last week, down from 635 the previous week, and the final clearance rate for Melbourne was similar week on week, with last week's clearance rate recorded at 68.6%. Melbourne's clearance rate 1 year ago was 57.2% across 791 auctions, so volumes again remain lower. And in Sydney, 503 homes went to auction across the city last week, with a final clearance rate of 67.9%, and this is the highest clearance rate the city has seen since Easter 2018. Over the same week last year, 634 auctions were held in Sydney, while the clearance rate was a lower 49.7%. But once again, volumes remained muted. So now, set that against the latest analysis of the RBA household ratios and our mortgage stress data, as we discussed in our post, Household Debt and Mortgage Stress Both Move Higher. We released the June 2019 mortgage stress results based on our running 52,000 household surveys, and we found that 32% of households are now dealing with mortgage stress. That's a record, meaning they're having cash flow issues managing their finances and mortgage repayments. This translates into more than 1,063,000 households spread across the country and nearly 71,000 risk default in the year ahead, even taking into account the fall in mortgage repayments represented by the recent rate cuts. Bank losses will rise. This is because the cost of living continues to run ahead of incomes, while households have larger debts and are being enticed to buy into the current complex risk environment. The top postcodes in stress are those in the outer suburban fringe areas, where many large estates are still being built and households are super highly leveraged. And the RBA released their March 2019 data on household ratios. Whilst these series include small business finance and include households not borrowing, the trends continue to tell an interesting story of debt and yet more debt. The household debt-to-income ratio is at a record 189.7, while the housing debt-to-income ratio was 140.1, again a record, and the owner-occupied housing debt-to-income ratio was also up to 109.3. These are high numbers on a trend and international comparable basis. Households are literally drowning in debt. And finally, the RBA debt-to-assets data shows the pincer movement as home prices fall and debt rises. This is now heading towards the highest we have ever seen. The obvious conclusion is that the debt burden is too great, mortgage stress will go on rising until the balance between debt and income is restored. And Westpac expects the RBA to cut again in November and is also forecasting a weaker Aussie dollar ahead. And these are not signs of a strong and robust economy. But that said, the markets have been pretty strong this week, driven by a stronger US market and the RBA cuts. Locally, the ASX 100 closed 0.46% higher on Friday to 5,587. The ASX Financials Index was up 0.59% to 6,416. And the local volatility index was down 2.5% to 1028. Among the major banks, the ANZ ended slightly lower at 28.15. CBA was up 0.85% to 82.26. NAB was up 0.3% to 26.97. And Westpac was up 0.35% to 28.35. Among the regionals, the Bank of Queensland was up 0.53% to 9.55. Bendigo and Adelaide was up 0.87% to 10.56. And Suncorp closed 0.7% higher at 13.60. Macquarie was up 0.7% to 129.79, while AMP was flat at 217. Genworth, the mortgage insurer, was down 0.35% to 284. McGrath, the real estate agent, was flat at 24.5 cents. And Yellow Brick Road was down 1.43% to 6.9 cents. The Aussie ended at 69.8 cents, having tried to get above 70 cents earlier in the week, but fell on a stronger US dollar. Down 0.56%. The Aussie Gold Cross was down 0.56% to 2004, and the Aussie Bitcoin Cross was down 0.81% to 15,816. Hi, excuse the interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. Over in the US, weaker expectations of an aggressive interest rate cut by the Federal Reserve later this month and the weak economic data in Germany helped to take the markets off the records they hit earlier in the week. This was driven by some strong US job numbers. The jobs report estimated that non-farm payrolls rose by 224,000 in June compared with the consensus 160,000 as government employees rose by the most in 10 months. The unemployment rate ticked up slightly to 3.7%, but still at levels last seen 50 years ago, but that was explained by more people looking for jobs. That better-than-expected showing reduced the likelihood that the Fed will cut interest rates at its next meeting later this month. Before this, there were expectations of an equity-friendly rate cut of 25 or even 50 basis points, which helped push the S&P 500 to record highs earlier. Before the job release, Wall Street was pricing in a near certain reduction in rates, with the market placing a 25% probability that the Fed would cut by 50 basis points rather than its typical 25. After the release, the probability of a 50 basis point cut fell to 5.9%, though expectations for a cut of at least a quarter point remained at 100%. But one analyst said that the stronger-than-expected report is likely to throw cold water on those fairly dovish expectations. Stocks don't respond well to rising interest rates. Also on investors' radar were more ongoing trade negotiations between the US and China. Markets rallied earlier this week on the news that President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping had agreed to restart trade negotiations and Chinese purchases of US agricultural products, while the US pledged to not implement new tariffs and to allow US tech companies to sell some goods to Chinese telecom giant Huawei. But details as to the exact nature of the reprieve remain lacking. And while there are reports that American negotiators will visit Beijing next week, posturing by both sides has called into question the path forward for an ultimate deal. Beijing has given no details as to the timing and magnitude of agricultural purchases. Also, Chinese Ministry of Commerce spokesman Jiao Fang said on Thursday that a deal could only be reached if the US agrees to remove all tariffs, contrary to Washington's position that some tariffs must remain in place to assure Chinese compliance. One analyst wrote on Thursday, "I am less confident than before that a trade deal will be done, since, unlike earlier this year, the interminable US presidential election season has now begun. This means Trump will have to defend any deal with Beijing against Democratic criticism. It also remains the case that the Fed, via its dovish language of late, has enabled Trump's hard line on trade." Trading volumes were light because many investors were taking the day off after the Independence Day holiday. And at the close, the Dow Jones Industrial Average declined 0.16% to 26,922, while the S&P 500 index fell 0.18% to 2,990, and the Nasdaq Composite Index declined 0.10% to 8,161. The US Financial Index was flat at 466.05, and the best performer of the session on the Dow Jones Industrial Average was Goldman Sachs, which rose 0.91% to 207.91 at the close. For the week, the S&P 500 finished up 1.7% and is up 19.3% for the year. The Dow gained 1.2% and is up 15.4%. The Nasdaq gained 1.9% and pushed its year-to-date change to 22%. And the Volatility Index was up 5.65% to 13.28. But rates did end the day higher. The 10-year Treasury yield moved up to 2.048 from Wednesday's 1.953, their lowest levels since November 2016. And the three-month rate is 2.23, up 0.22%, reflecting the changed view of future interest rates from the Fed, although the yield curve remains inverted, signalling a potential recession ahead. In European equities, German data showed industrial orders had fallen far more than expected in May, and there was a warning from the economy ministry that this sector of Europe's largest economy was likely to remain weak in the coming months. Devastating new orders data just undermined any hopes for an industrial rebound. "We're starting to lose our optimism," said one analyst. "Combined with the weakest June performance of the labour market since 2002 and disappointing retail sales, today's new orders wrap up a week to forget for the German economy. The fear factor is back." The pan-European Stoxx 600 index lost 0.72% and the euro-US dollar was down 0.52% to 1.1225. Deutsche Bank rose 2.49% to 7.14 as it is set to announce this week that its regulatory chief, Salvi Mathrat, is leaving. The Financial Times reported, "Mathrat has come under heavy criticism for a string of anti-money laundering failures and other compliance issues that have hurt the bank's reputation." And one of Deutsche Bank's largest clients, hedge fund giant Renaissance Technologies, has been pulling money out of its prime brokerage accounts with the German lender for the past few months, according to Bloomberg. Though it remains a big client, Renaissance has been shifting some of its business to Barclays and Bank of America, as well as others. Deutsche Bank's hedge fund business has been declining for years. Through to the end of 2018, revenue from executing trades and lending securities to hedge funds fell more than one-third from 2015. Gold futures for August delivery was down 1.36% to 1,401.60, having reached a high on Tuesday. And elsewhere in commodities trading, crude oil for delivery in August rose 0.68% to 57.73 a barrel. The US dollar index futures was up 0.42% to 97.17, and China's Shanghai Composite Index gained 0.19% to 3,011. The British pound has broken down significantly for the week, testing the 1.25 level underneath. Ultimately, this is an area that should continue to make a lot of noise, but if we were to break below the 1.25 level, that would, of course, be very negative for the British pound, as it would accelerate the downside. That being said, this is a market that should continue to be very noisy and, of course, be plagued by the Brexit issue, which doesn't seem to make any sense anymore. The pound dropped 0.42% to 1.2524, the FTSE was down 0.66% to 7,553, and the financials index was down 0.61% to 722.42. And Bitcoin fell 1.75% on Friday to 11,023, with continuing volatility. Finally, back to the Fed, who published their latest monetary policy on Friday. They said that economic activity increased at a solid pace in the early part of 2019 and that the labour market has continued to strengthen. However, inflation has been running below the Federal Open Market Committee's FOMC longer-run objective of 2%. At its meeting in June, the FOMC judged that the current and prospective economic conditions call for maintaining the target rate of the federal funds rate at 2.25% to 2.5%. Nonetheless, in light of increased uncertainties around the economic outlook and muted inflation pressures, the committee indicated that it would closely monitor the implications of upcoming information for the economic outlook and will act as appropriate to sustain the expansion, with a strong labour market and inflation near the committee's symmetric 2% objective. They said that survey-based measures of the expected path of the policy rate also shifted down relative to the levels observed at the end of 2018. According to the results of the most recent survey of primary dealers and survey of market participants, both conducted by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York just before the June meeting, the median of respondents' modal projections implies a declining trajectory for the target rate of the federal funds rate for 2019, which flattens out in 2020. Rather to the December survey, the median of these projections moved down 50 basis points for July 2019 and 100 basis points for December 2019. Additional market-based measures of uncertainty about policy rates approximately 1 to 2 years ahead increased on balance from their levels at the end of last December. And they also called out that ongoing gains in household wealth have likely continued to support consumer spending. House prices, which are of particular importance for the balance sheet positions of a large portion of households, continue to increase through May, although at a more moderate pace than in recent years. In addition, US equity prices, which fell sharply at the end of 2018, have rebounded this year, buoyed by increases in home and equity prices. Aggregate household net worth moved up to 6.8 times household income in the first quarter. And aggregate flows of credit to large non-financial firms remained strong in the first quarter, supported in part by relatively low interest rates and accommodative financing conditions. The gross issuance of corporate bonds, which had fallen substantially in December, rebounded in the first quarter as market volatility receded. After increasing notably in late 2018, spreads on both investment and speculative grade corporate bonds over comparable maturity treasury securities have both declined on net this year as investors' risk appetite seems to have recovered. And in April, respondents to the Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey on bank lending practices reported that demand for commercial and industrial loans weakened in the first quarter, even as lending standards remained unchanged and terms for such loans eased. However, banks reported tightening lending standards on all categories of commercial real estate loans, and meanwhile, financing conditions for small businesses have remained generally accommodative, but credit growth has been subdued. But standing back, it appears that the Federal Reserve's principal tool, adjusting short-term interest rates and quantitative easing for accomplishing the 2% inflation and low unemployment targets, are radically out of sync with a global economy that relies on the dollar. The Phillips curve is all but dead. The annual movements in the consumer price index, less food and energy, have largely fluctuated between 1% and 2%, whether unemployment exceeded 10%, the Fed set short-term rates near zero and bought long-term treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, or unemployment fell below 4% and the Fed raised short-term rates and ran down its balance sheet. This is partially a function of the nature of the US economy, open not just to imports of manufacturers from China, but also products from emerging Asian nations and an increasing array of services from places like India, thanks to the internet. So the global supplies of labor capital and technology remain remarkably plentiful despite low US unemployment and stronger growth. The tariffs won't change it much. If iPhones aren't assembled in China, production will move elsewhere, and services are immune from tariffs and many border regulations. Frankly, the Phillips curve is bust. The US dollar has become the de facto trading currency, with more than 40% of all cross-border trade and 6% of international debt financing denominated in US dollars, even though the United States is less than one-fifth of the global economy. Foreign banks, businesses, and individual investors of all sizing now hold dollar-denominated securities, monetizing US foreign policy. While China throws billions around through its Belt and Road initiatives, US banks, for example Citibank, have built transnational payment systems that provide the plumbing for global commerce and finance. Now, when long-term rates move up, all those holding dollars abroad can use the Citibank pipeline and similar facilities to access higher US yields and push those rates back down. And when Ben Bernanke raised the federal funds rate in 2004-6, longer-term Treasury rates hardly budged. And when the Fed pushed up short-term rates three times in 2017, long-term rates were similarly stubborn. Foreign monetary authorities hold over $5 trillion US dollars in treasury and mortgage-backed securities, corporate bonds and stocks to back up their currencies, and they purchase and sell these to lower or raise the value of their currency against the dollar to stimulate or break their domestic economies and influence interest rates on US securities. And last year, as the Trump administration imposed tariffs on Chinese goods, Chinese monetary authorities permitted the yuan to fall against the dollar, partially frustrating US efforts to reduce imports and boost manufacturing. Neither the Fed nor the Treasury, despite managing the truly global currency, have similarly large holdings of highly rated German, Japanese, Chinese, and other major currency securities. But the Fed should. And then, as it sells US securities, as it has recently, with the potential to raise long-term rates, the Fed could sell foreign securities to also push up rates in those debt instruments. This would mitigate the flood of foreign investors into US securities and permit US long-term rates to rise with more certainty. The same would apply when it undertakes quantitative easing to boost the economy, with such recognition that monetary policy must be executed on the global stage and not merely on the trading floors for US bonds in New York. And to add to this, the Bank for International Settlements, the BIS, wrote in its annual economic report that monetary policy can no longer be the main engine of economic growth, and other policy drivers need to kick in to ensure the global economy achieves suitable momentum. In its flagship economic report, the BIS calls for a better balance between monetary policy, structural reforms, fiscal policy, and macroprudential measures. This would, they say, allow the global economy to move away from the debt-fueled growth model that risks turbulence ahead. And that's the point. Central banks around the world have trapped themselves into narrow groupthink, where inflation targeting and monetary levers are the tools of choice. But as we discussed in our post, has the RBA lost its way? We need fresh thinking, or we will just drive interest rates ever lower, balloon debt higher, and repeat the same one-way trip to cut and cut again. Central banks, rather than helping, are creating the economic bind the world is in. Even the banker's banker says as much. So the question becomes, will they wake up from their slumbers or take us further into economic oblivion? I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.